Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Joining us is Gregory A. Fournier, and we're going to talk about his book Terror in Ypsilanti. It's the John Norman Collins Unmasked book. Thank you for being here, Greg.
Thank you for having me.
Wow. So this is quite a story. So, Greg, what got you into this story enough to write a book?
It's a very personal story with me. I lived a block up the street from John Collins and had several interactions with him that were negative interactions, but I didn't know his name. I didn't know him, really. And then walking home from classes at Eastern Michigan University one afternoon, his house where he rented a room was cordoned off, surrounded by half a dozen police cars and a crowd of about 50 people. And, you know, so obviously I knew something was happening, and well, when I got there, I said, "Well, you know, what's happening?" And somebody told me the guy who's killed all those girls was just arrested in that house. So that was my first link between him, me, and who he was. And in the evening papers, it was announced. His name was announced, John Norman Collins, captured, suspected killer of blah, blah. And so, of course, that left a big impression on me. And then a book came out called The Michigan Murders 5 years later, and it changed the names of the victims. It masked the killer's name and novelized a story, a very free novelization of a story. And so as years went on, people were more and more confused about, well, what really happened, and was it this place or that place? So when I retired in 2009, I wrote a book called Zug Island. And then for my second project, I thought, well, there's a great story that happened just down the street from me that has never been told in a factual way. So I then and there decided to write a nonfiction treatment of his story, and it's done very well.
I'm curious to know how your story expands on that novel, because I read that novel this week, and the whole time, I read it before years ago, but just to refresh myself, and I was curious reading it. I noticed a lot of things seem to be changed. Of course, the killer's name, but obviously, as you were saying, it's fictionalized. So how does your book differ from it in that sense?
Well, I can say that, first of all, it is a story that I'm uniquely able to tell. I understood the campus culture 50 years mm-hmm. ago. I lived a block up the street. We knew many of the same people. I did not know any of the victims personally, but when I became a teacher in Ypsilanti, I would have had one of the victims as an English student, and I had some of her friends. And people in town really didn't talk about it at all for, you know, almost 50 years. It was, you know, kind of the town's hidden secret. And so I started writing the book and contacting people, and people who I had known through my Ypsilanti experience started coming forward. And it just, the story started telling itself. And the broad strokes of the Michigan Murders book covers the Karen Sue Bynum case mainly. And I tried to give more details about the six other murders, and much of that information had never been published before, and not in the Michigan Murders as well. So I tried to give a rounder portrait, and I also did not want to do anything that was lurid make things up about the victims, because there was not a lot of quality information. The parents of the victims didn't want to talk. And Edward Keyes, the Michigan Murders author, really did not talk to anybody that was related to the victims. And essentially, they went by what was in the newspapers and what the police and authorities told him. Mm-hmm. So I have a rounder portrayal of it, 50 years of hindsight, mm-hmm. and an understanding of campus culture. And in addition to that, three of his professors, he was an English major, and I am and was an English major, those three professors I also had, and they came forward with information. So, and I could go on. The second part of the book is about the court case, and a lot of that was in Keyes's book, too, although there were liberties taken with that story. I got all of my information from newspaper accounts and legal government documents. I had the Freedom of Information Act request on thousands of pages of prison and state police documents. But it's really the third part of my book that is totally new, and that's about John Collins' years in prison. And there's not much about him through the first two-thirds of the book, because he didn't talk at all on lawyer's orders during his court case. And, of course, we didn't know who he was while he was killing all of these girls. But the prison part of the book, he starts reaching out to the press and trying to create an alibi and a justification and to make people feel that he is the victim, not the girls he killed. And all of those things were not in that original book. So, and I'm very proud of that part.
Well, I appreciate you expanding on that. And I was curious, too. I know that in the original trial, most of the evidence was considered circumstantial evidence, which is apparently how he manages to claim that, you know, he's the victim in all this. But Sheriff Douglas Harvey, in a recent interview, said that there were some DNA testing going on, and that DNA belonging to Collins had been found on clothing belonging to one of the victims or something like that. Could you explain what's actually going on?
He would know more about that than I would. John never willingly gave up his DNA because he said, oh, the government, the police, they'll try to entrap me somehow and find me guilty when I'm not and one thing or another. In 2002, though, in Michigan, all of the, prison inmates had to give up a cheek swab and get the DNA. And he, Sheriff Harvey, seems to think that one of the later murders, Alice Callum, or Cologne, I'm not sure, I think it's Callum, he had picked her up at a dance and whatnot, and she was on his motorcycle. And according to Doug, he must have reached back and grabbed her on the thigh while they were driving, and some of his sweat and epithelials were found on her pantyhose. I can't corroborate that myself, but he's more in a position to know than I am. Now I'll defer to his judgment on that.
Yeah, and on that note, I had a question. Al and I were discussing this before you came on. The story that he told about the psychic Peter Hurkos. Do you have any? Can you expand on that and tell us how much of that is actually true?
Most of the Herco stuff is true, and the reason I can say that confidently is that Peter was a publicity hound. He was a celebrity psychic, and so everywhere he went, everything he did while he was in Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor. He had the press following him around. And so, all of the information that we have about Peter is accurate. And the one very amazing thing that Peter said, he went into the basement where Karen Sue Beineman was murdered, and he used to do I forget what he called it, but vibrations, you know, the things, inanimate objects would give off a certain aura or a vibration. So he would go down in the basement and he'd feel on the floor and look all, you know, what over. Anyway, he had a prediction that when the guy, the murderer, was killed, that he would be a foreigner, he would have Canadian money in his pocket, and that there was a makeshift ladder laying on the floor somewhere in his vision. And as it turned out, when Sheriff Harvey and the rest of the police, the investigators, went down in that basement, they found a ladder laying along the wall. And when Collins was arrested, they discovered he was born in Canada, and he did have some Canadian money in his pocket, probably because he was thinking of, you know, escaping across the Ambassador Bridge into Windsor. That's the only reason I would think that he would have Canadian money in his pocket. But Sheriff Harvey said, I'm very skeptical, but when he said those three things, the hair stood up on the back of my neck. And but Peter Hurkos, in further discovery, we found out that he had secretly come into town. He had a private investigator do a lot of his snooping around for him, and he was able to glean that information. So there's no psychic power there. As a footnote to all of this, and I've never told anybody this before, Peter Hurkos' widow lives rather close to me, probably within 30 miles. And she got in touch with me, and I thought, oh, she's going to be upset, give me a hard time. I tried to tell it like it was, and about Peter being a fraud and so on. And she wanted me to ghostwrite her story about her life with Peter. And she was his shill in his Hollywood act and his Las Vegas act. Very pretty, blonde girl, very buxom distraction, which is what a shill does. And she asked me if I would write his story and fulfill the final chapter of his prophecy. And I said, no, I backed off of that one. I don't do ghostwriting and so on. So, and she says, well, I really like your style. And I said, I'm surprised because, you know, I was critical of your husband. And she says, well, it's not being critical when you tell the truth. So I took that as a great compliment.
Wasn't he also involved in the Lindbergh kidnapping case?
No, he was involved.
Oh, Boston Strangler.
The Boston Strangler
case.
He was self-involved. Nobody asked him to come to Boston, but his career was on the skids. In the 60s, celebrity psychics were all the rage on Johnny Carson and the Mike Douglas show, those types of shows, Merv Griffin. And but after a while, it was getting old, and he wasn't getting the bookings anymore. And so he went to Boston, interjected himself in the case, and got himself arrested by the Boston police, and they were going to press charges if he didn't get out of town immediately. They did not want an amateur in there messing up their investigation. And what really sealed it for the police was when Herkos impersonated a Boston police detective and started harassing one of the witnesses of the Boston Strangler case. I don't know what the man witnessed. He didn't witness any of the killings, but he was somehow connected to it. And Peter Herkos just leaned on him real, real hard. But what Herkos didn't know was this man was emotionally disturbed, suffered from severe depression, and he had to be hospitalized after Peter Herkos tried to scare him into giving him information. So Herkos was arrested, and I already told the other part of the story. You get out of town or we're pressing charges. And he couldn't get out of town fast enough.
Wow. Well, I really appreciate you expanding on that, because now it all makes sense. but I also wanted to ask you, there's theories that Collins was involved in murders in California as well. Could you talk about that and what evidence there is to indicate he may be responsible for those crimes?
Well, one in particular, he was suspected of possibly three. He was left Ypsilanti. The police are starting to close in a little too much on him. And in addition to being a killer and a butcher, really, he was a compulsive thief. And him and his buddy, roommate, had been out stealing credit cards and wallets and breaking into houses and cars and so on. Well, the police were starting to close in on him, so he and his friend fraudulently rented a trailer with a check that they had stolen from one of the apartments that they broke into.
That's right.
Paid rental, so it was a fraudulent check. And they took the trailer out to Salinas. Andy Manuel, Collins, his friend. His grandparents lived in Bolinas. So they went out and parked the trailer in the alley for free in back of his grandfather's house. And they were only there for, well, it was under a week, 4 or 5 days at the very most. And a young 17-year-old.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
An old woman called Roxy Phillips was found dead, cut up, and thrown in Pescadero Canyon. I don't know, 10 miles away. 15 miles away from Salinas. And there was evidence, physical evidence, linking Collins to the crime. And real quickly, one of the California detectives working the case and who found the body developed a real bad case of poison oak. And he thought, well, I wonder if the killer happened to have poison oak too. So the detective went around within a 5 mile radius, whatever, and asked different doctors if anybody treated somebody for poison oak recently from Michigan. And lo and behold, one of the doctors said yes, and they had his name. You know, John Collins, or he may have given a false name, that part I'm not sure of. But Collins panicked. He took the car to a Pontiac dealer, had the trailer hitch taken off. They deserted the trailer, and him and Andy Manuel went back to Michigan in a trip that was supposed to take 3 weeks to a month, was about a 10-day trip. And the landlady had not rented the rooms out or anything, so they just moved right back into their old rooms and hid out there. When the body was found, there she, Roxy, had on a red print dress, a little floral prints, and with a matching belt. They found her nude body with this belt around her neck, and she had been strangled to death. Back in Michigan now, Collins is under suspicion for the murder of Karen Sue Bynum, and his car is impounded. They take it apart, and they take the seats out, and they find on the seat rail a piece of fabric, red fabric, with the same floral print, the same warp and weave in the fabric, 100% identical. And that linked Collins with direct physical evidence to the California murder. That was a slam dunk case out in California. And there were two witnesses that saw her in his car.
Well, he had a problem with that. Now, that's how he came to the attention of authorities, right? It was witnesses who saw him with the victims. Wasn't he seen with at least three or four of the victims?
You know,
in Michigan?
One that I'm sure of, well, actually, the first one, the Fleischer murder, yes, he had been seen at Silver Lake with her. And Alice Callum, he had been seen with her. But I was able to pinpoint that he had been seen or was known to have been with each of the seven victims. And police will tell you, you know, they don't believe when it comes to crime that there's anything real about coincidence. Yeah. Usually it's cover-up. But here we have the coincidence of him being able to, of Collins, being able to place him with all seven of the victims. Now, I would say that goes way, way beyond coincidence. Again, it's circumstantial, but you can be convicted on circumstantial evidence.
Oh, yeah.
And if there's the weight of it, and it's compelling enough.
Well, and that brings up another point, too. How does he justify claiming that he's the victim in this case, or that he's somehow innocent when they're... I mean, what are the odds that somebody would be connected to seven of the victims but didn't kill them?
That's what narcissists do. That's all I can answer that one. He can't take any personal responsibility for anything. Everyone is a liar but him. And he really, over the years, hasn't been very effective at convincing people of that. He's his own enemy.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he also, didn't he do some local interview for a local television station shortly after he was convicted in the 80s or
something? It was about, I'd say 10 years later. It might even be about 10 years later, yeah. And he wanted to set up almost like a kangaroo court where he could act as his own lawyer because he wasn't allowed to speak during the trial.
Yeah.
So here he wanted to speak as his own lawyer question the prosecutor, question Sheriff Harvey, other people connected with his conviction. And then a number of his supporters were out in the live audience. Now, Collins is doing this on a remote from Marquette Prison in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. With a Detroit station. So they sent one of their reporters, Marilyn Turner, and she interviewed him. And he hadn't really been around, you know, an attractive woman for a long time in one thing or another, you know, fill in the blank. So she goes up to interview him in prison. And you can tell that he's just very taken with her. And she, in a very masterful way, made him relax and, you know, tell his story. And, you know, again, it's all lies.
Yeah.
And then she asked him, John, do you love your mother? And he lost it. He couldn't talk. It's really about the only time he hasn't been able to talk. She hit him right where he lives. And he got a little bit weepy and, I love my mom. But he had, if he did, it was a love-hate relationship with her.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because the story that I've heard is that his mother was a prostitute. And that
Sheriff Harvey again.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That's a story I heard that John had caught his mother with a trick, and that's been cited as some kind of traumatic experience that could have caused this or whatever. So you're throwing water on that, saying that it may not be true.
Well, yeah, yes and no. I think the word prostitute is where it all falls apart for me. Because I asked Doug, and we've become friends since it took 5 years to write this book. He and I got together quite a few times. And he made that pronouncement at a Kiwanis meeting in Ann Arbor. And I asked him, I said, well, did you have any corroboration? Was there any physical evidence, any evidence, eyewitness, whatever? And he said no. But here's the deal with his mother. She may not have been the best mom. She was a single mom living in a very small, basically Catholic community. She sent her kids to Catholic school, but she never went to church, never went to any school events, never went to any of his sporting events, and he lettered in 3 sports in high school. She was a waitress, and she had to pay a mortgage and take care of 3 kids, and she worked very hard. But she was a single mom, and in that era, people would gossip.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of that talk was gossip. She's a single woman. She's able to date who she wants to. There had been a few men in her life besides her 2 husbands, but a prostitute, no. A lonely single mom, I would say yes to that. And I did talk to one of John's high school friends who came home with him one day early from school. The boiler in the school broke down. It was winter, and they sent all the kids home. So John says, come on home and we can lift some weights in my basement. So they go to the house, and as they're going in the back door and down the stairs, this person said that he looked off to the left through the kitchen and into the living room, and John's mother was there on the couch making out with some guy.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing, it wasn't, they were naked, it was nothing like that, but just,
just normal stuff.
I'm with someone. And you can imagine that, that kid probably told somebody who told somebody else, and then it got in the church rumor mill, and then it just grew from there. But no, I would not call her a prostitute, nor would I say that about his older sister either. Mm-hmm. His older sister, her problem was, not a problem, she liked older men. So when she was, a late teen, 17, 18, 19 years old, she was going out with guys in their mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
So mom and daughter were considered flamboyant, notorious people. And they both dressed to the nines. They always had their hair done. Looked like they spent a lot of time at the hairdresser. They wore costume jewelry, and just did not fit the mold of what people thought a mother should be.
Well, doesn't that fall into the ultimate problem that people have trying to explain why these people do these kinds of things? They want some sort of easy answer like that. Well, his mother was a prostitute and he was traumatized and things. Because I've read a lot of strange things about him.
Killed a bunch of women.
Yeah.
That's basically what most people will surmise. He hated his mother. And I'm not going to deny that he had very mixed and hard feelings about her from other people I know who know Collins and had seen him interact with his mother. And, you know, he was frustrated with her. I think he felt that she was a little too flirtatious, and he didn't particularly like the way she dressed. Believe it or not, Collins was a conservative Catholic. And so I think he had probably been embarrassed by his mother. But I think what really made him flip, in my humble opinion, because I'm not a psychologist, he had a girlfriend in high school, and it was fairly steady, but, you know, off again, on again, and through the high school years. He went to Central Michigan. And I don't know, she probably went to Wayne State or somebody, but she went to a different school. They drifted apart. And Collins really missed her a lot. And he came home on a weekend or the Christmas holiday or something like that and asked her to go out and to see a movie. And then when they got together, he didn't take her to a movie. He went to Grosse Pointe, parked in a real dark place up on the shore of the Detroit River, or maybe it was this Lake St. Clair River. I don't remember which, but and he wanted her to go out to the pier. He sit on the pier and talk. And she said, "I thought we were going to a movie." "No, I don't want to go out there. What's on your mind?" So they had to talk. And he said, "I just want to know if we could, you know, if you still have feelings for me, and if maybe we could, try to get together again." And she told him no. I think that was a rejection that may have snapped, something may have snapped for Collins. I believe he grew up feeling like he was the unwanted third child, because the mother, her second child, was a girl and a female. Basically that was her alter ego. And growing up, they spent a lot of time together and got a lot of the attention, and John felt neglected. And then when his high school girlfriend neglected him, I believe that he got just something snapped inside of him. Then, flashing back into Ypsilanti and the first victim, when Mary Fleischer rejected him, that might have been more than he could stand. And there was such rage that he wreaked upon her body that it's even difficult to describe what he did to her.
Sounds like your book is definitely something we should read, because already in this conversation you've cleared up quite a bit of confusion for me.
Yeah,
and I have I sold an option to a Toronto media company. They're trying to come up with a short trailer and hopefully sell it as a movie project, and I hope they do.
That's exciting. Now, do you have a website?
Yes, I do. GregoryAFournier.com, and that's my author site. And I have a blog that's got about 425 posts on it about different things I write and history. I'm a regional author. I live in California, but I'm a Michigan boy, and I write about Detroit topics. And my blog is Fornology. I dropped the U out of my name. Fornology, F-O-R-N-O-L-O-G-Y.com. And that is, you know, my main marketing tool as well.
Great.
And I have a book coming out here. I'm 2 weeks from sending it to the publisher on Detroit's Purple Gang during the 20s and 30s. A gang refutative killed over 500 people in their 10-year reign of terror. So
wow.
my topics are a bit dark, but they do very well.
Great. Well, we'll have your book up on our website as well as your website link so people can do one click. And we recommend the book, Terror in Ypsilanti, John Norman Collins Unmasked, and our guest has been the author, Gregory A. Fonier. Thanks for being here, Greg.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.